From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of the upcoming Stutz Artists Annual Open House.
I'll find out what's going on at the Vonnegut Memorial Library.
And I'll talk with Dr. Eric Stark about conducting Bach's B minor Mass. And of course, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Stutz Artists Association Annual Open House, one of the premier arts events in Indianapolis, will be April 29th and 30th. This year, it's a family affair for Carol and Brian Myers, mother and son. Carol is the chair of this year's event, and Brian earned a studio residency at Stutz. Carol calls Brian her most trusted critic, and the two stopped in to tell Sharon what drew them to art and what preparing for the open house is like.
Today, we're going to talk about What'll we do about the Stutz Open House? See? I don't think we've ever started an interview that way. It might be a new tradition. I love it.
There you go.
So the we, in this case, comprises not one but two artists from the same family. And I want to talk about, we're going to talk about the Stutz event, but I want to talk about, Carol, how did you discover your inner artist?
Well, I think I've always had my inner artist. There's a lot of social, you can't make a living that way, so I went to nursing school. But I've always created artwork. It's just kind of a part of who I am.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, so you saw that growing up. How did you realize you were an artist?
You know, I think it's something that developed over time. Again, seeing that growing up in the house, mom being a fiber artist and a printmaker and always sort of being active and maintaining a studio in the house. Father as well, taking photographs. So I was surrounded by it, I think, from an early age, and something that just developed over time, I think.
Did you do a little experimenting, and this question for both of you, before, you know, the cool thing about visual art is there are so many ways to express it. You can paint, you can take photos, you can do pottery, you can do fiber. Did you experiment a little bit before you finally found something that just said, oh, that's it. That's, I need to work with oil paint, or I need to work with textile. Did you shop around a little?
For me, I'm still in that, where do I want to focus? I love it all. I focused in school on printmaking because I love line. And then I've always sewn, so when I'm doing something with fiber, I consider the stitch my line. Mm. And so it's really all related. I kind of go in a lot of different directions that way.
And that's been pretty exciting, watching mom go through that exploration process. You know, I think from an early age, I was on the painting and drawing kind of grabbed me, the oil paint.
Mm-hmm.
as a mode. You asked a question about finding your artist or inner artist.
Mm-hmm.
It's been exciting to watch mom kind of really explore the vast array of materials and methods applicable to the process. And I feel like I do a similar thing as far as experimenting a little bit with some sculptural medium, printmaking a little bit. But primarily painting and drawing has kind of been what my main interest.
You know, it's funny. I said to Jen Schmitz-Thomas, who coordinated our interview together, I said, you know, I am a little familiar and certainly was aware of both of your work, but it never occurred to me that you were related. Have you ever worked together on a piece? Have you ever thought about it?
I don't think we've worked together on anything, but what I've always been fascinated with is when I look at Brian's paintings, I can feel how it must have felt to make that mark.
Really?
So I feel really connected to the work.
Hmm. Have you ever thought about something you might do together?
You know, we've never really talked about that. We've talked about at least collaborating on the process, setting up to do a printmaking project, for instance. Of course, coordinating. Never really come together.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard. You both have busy lives, too.
You know, I guess one of my earliest memories was sitting down in Mom's studio at her drafting table, which I thought was the greatest thing in the world. I'm sitting down at the drafting table, and she'd let me use her fancy drawing pencils and said, you know, I think it was a vase of flowers, and I sat down and was really intent on capturing this in graphite, and, you know, sitting in the pilot seat there was pretty exciting. In a room that was the studio, which was at one point off limits to be granted access to that space.
She knew you were trustworthy by that point.
So
I still have that drawing.
Aww. It's not on the fridge.
No, it's not on the fridge.
It's probably in the stacks and stacks of all the other paper and artworks. And
did you ever discourage your son? You know, you made reference earlier to it is not easy to make a living as any kind of artist. But did you ever say to him, "Oh, honey, just make sure you have some other backup plan, some plan B"?
Never.
Really?
Never.
What got you to the point where you trusted that?
I think she was happy to see me come home and stop hitchhiking on the West Coast and being a general vagrant. I think they were excited just to see a little bit of focus coming through.
Yeah.
And that's just my impression or side of it. But
well, I think it was clear when he got to high school that this was an important part of who he was. And whether you decide to be an engineer and paint on the side or you decide to be an artist, I still kind of celebrated seeing that move into a comfort zone that was really an important place for him.
And I should say that you do have a day job, so to speak, with Heron. Explain what that is.
Basically, my job at Heron is running a general workshop. It's a wood shop that is open to all students throughout the school. So foundation students use the shop as a three-dimensional design studio. Painting students build frames. So it's a wood shop workshop area that I run. I also teach basic drawing, basic painting, each semester and throughout the summer, color theory. In addition to that, so it's a staff job as opposed to a faculty position.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a stable, 40 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, art related position.
Mm-hmm.
It's fortunate not to have to work a menial job, so it's exciting to be connected with the Heron School and seeing the students kind of develop. And my position is unique over there because I get to see them come in as foundation students as they develop into more of the fine art fields, the painting, the drawing, the printmaking. They utilize my workshop area quite heavily. So,
do you ever? I'm curious about this. You're essentially surrounded by, and they may be beginners, but they're certainly people on the path to being working artists in some way, shape, or form, because they're at Heron. They've gained admission to Heron, and they're developing artists. When you see what they're doing, are you ever inspired? Do you ever go home and say, "Oh my gosh, that's the beginning of an idea that I want to adapt and do something different"? Or do you keep your own work protected in within your own studio walls?
You know, I'm certainly inspired by the energy and the look on the face of a student when they try something new and it happens and it works for them, and they begin to say, "Oh, I can develop that and take that to the next level."
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think in my studio practice, I get frustrated at times because, "Oh, I'm doing the same thing over and over again. What to do next? What to do next?" And to sort of witness that ideation process and the development of that basic ideation process to a level of excitement, and then to the next level and to the next sort of stage in development is that's the inspiration that I think I get most from watching the students develop from year to year, from day to day, from week to week. So it's not so much that I'm working in a vacuum, I think. I'm surrounded by, and that ties into the Stutz community as well.
That's what I was going to ask. You obviously have a very different, both of you have a very different kind of context within your working artists at the Stutz, mm-hmm. fellow working artists, I should say.
Well, in some ways, it's very much like Heron in that to be a member of the Stutz Artist Association, really all you need to do is have a studio and be paying rent at the Stutz Business Center. And so there's really all level of artists working at the Stutz, many people just beginning to take themselves seriously. And so the Stutz Artist Association and the residency program, which is funded by this big open house, is really a wonderful mixture of people that you can reach out and get a similar kind of experience. We're not in a vacuum so much as long as we open our studio doors and grab the folks in the hall. What do you think of this?
Yeah, I'm curious, how often do you see one another? Because it strikes me that since some people are night owls and some people probably go up at 5 in the morning and work, you could go through an entire day at the Stutz and not see fellow artists, I'm guessing.
Which is true. I mean, I generally keep a after work, evening, weekend mm-hmm. type hours. Some folks are there 9 to 5. So it's a range.
Yeah.
Are you ever tempted to go hang out with fellow artists, not because you're having a block, but because you're just not feeling motivated, or is it the other way around? Do you go?
Isn't that what a block is?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that what you do when you're blocked?
Well,
find
I guess
somebody
that's
else
probably true, but
there is some of that. There's again a certain sense of community and camaraderie. Maybe it's hey, let's just go have a glass of wine,
mm-hmm.
and you know that there's somebody down the hall. The lights are on. Knock on the door and hey, maybe see some new work or some work in progress or something that's completely in a moment of epic fail and they need the break as well. So it's hot and cold, I suppose.
Yeah. The thing that's really exciting about this time of year is the Stutz Open House is a big deal, both for artists and in the community for people being able to come and see it. And so many, many, many people move into the Stutz in these couple of months. And those of us that are there are spending more and more time there because we're creating our art. We'll be cleaning up our studios in a couple of weeks, hopefully, and getting ready for this wonderful opportunity to put our artwork in front of
thousands of people. Yeah.
And part of the reason that it's really personal to me this year, again, because this is our only major fundraiser that the Stutz Artist Association has, and it funds two residency studios for an entire year, and obviously Brian's one of those mm-hmm. residents, so there are just so many different layers of importance for this open house, importance for the artists to get their work in front of the public, important for the public to see the work, and also to support the residency and also our small gallery, the Stutz Art Space Gallery.
Mm-hmm. Now, the residency is merit-based, effectively, right? When you applied for the residency, were you thinking, this will never happen? Or were you thinking, gosh, if this happens, I make a promise to do this, this, and this in my work during the period of the residency?
Yeah, I think it is merit-based. Basically, for the Stutz residency, you do a pretty standard application as far as putting together a series of images, resume, bio, artist statement talking about your work, and it goes in front of a jury of Stutz artists mm-hmm. in the association. So it's a jury of peers, mm-hmm. Which is, again, relatively standard, and I think it's a good group of people that are concerned and really interested in who it is in the building that adds to that community.
Mm-hmm.
How does a resident contribute something, mm-hmm. give back to the Stutz arts community and remain active and present within the space?
And maybe both personality-wise and work-wise complement what's there already.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly so.
Are each of you creating works specifically for the open house, or are you selecting from works you already have created?
You know, I think speaking to the general level of activity in the building, I think everybody's in a flurry to just create new work, mm-hmm. to create new product. There's 5,000 people that come through the doors on Friday and Saturday, the last weekend in April. I think it's the 29th and 30th.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite an audience that comes through, and I think everybody's just on full tilt.
The lights will be on 24/7 exactly, over the next few weeks.
Pretty much.
Carol,
pretty
you're creating
much.
A lot of new work?
Yes, I am. And I'm because I have a show that I just hung at the Unitarian Church on 43rd Street, I have bare walls at this point. So I'm working very hard to have a whole new show when the time comes.
Sharon Gamble with artists Carol Myers and Brian Myers. You can see their work at the Stutz Artists Association's annual open house Friday, April 29th from 5:30 to 10:30 p.m. and Saturday, April 30th from 2 to 7 p.m. It's at the Stutz Business Center, 212 West 10th Street, Indianapolis. You can find out more at stutzartists.com. That's S-T-U-T-Z artists.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library is presenting its second annual Night of Vonnegut event, which will be held on April 16th at 7 p.m. at the Marat. Jim Scheller will serve as the MC, with Steve Inskeep of NPR's Morning Edition giving the keynote speech. Travis DiNicola spoke with Julia A. Whitehead, the executive director of the library, about the event.
Julia, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to see you here.
Thank you, Travis.
And congratulations on the library's been open a while now. You're about to have your second annual Night of Vonnegut. I know there's a bunch of other great news. Things are really rolling for you guys.
Yeah, things are great. Our opening day was wonderful. We had around 400 visitors.
Mm-hmm.
We had a young man come from South Carolina to present us with a painting of Vonnegut, and, you know, folks from Chicago and other places, and many, many Hoosiers just waiting for that opening day.
How very cool. Well, congratulations on that. And now that you're open, for people who may not be familiar with the Vonnegut Memorial Library, let's start with that. Where are you located, and what is it? And then we'll get into all the other stuff.
Sure. So we were offered this wonderful space by Katz & Corin Law Firm,
mm-hmm.
Just two blocks north of the State House. In the space that had been occupied by the IMOCA, the Indianapolis
mm-hmm.
Museum of Contemporary Art. And it's a beautiful setting.
Just sort of off the canal, right downtown.
It's
cool.
Wonderful, and it was very generous of Katz & Corin to give us the space for as long as we would like to stay there. It's perfect. We have an art gallery section that also includes art from others than just Vonnegut. But we have a touch screen that allows visitors to hear different interviews with friends of Vonnegut and scholars. And Morley Safer, who is one of
mm-hmm.
our honorary board members, does an introduction for visitors. So that's one room. We also have a museum room that includes a beautiful, large, very large painting of Vonnegut's life timeline. And it includes things that were happening in the world around the same time, but lots of good information about his life. There's a Dresden display that includes some of his war memorabilia that was donated to us by his children.
Mm-hmm. And that's appropriate just because of the book Slaughterhouse Five, which is
yes.
set in Dresden. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and we are trying to expand that exhibit. We're working with Creative Street
mm-hmm.
on making that exhibit more interactive with, you know, more information about what exactly happened in Dresden and,
yeah.
you know, why it happened and how to avoid it in the future. There's also the library, part of the library, the reading room, contains books that were donated by Half Price Books, and names of authors were given to us by Vonnegut's children. These authors are those that were included in their home library
mm-hmm.
And also friends of Vonnegut. So
okay.
we can't promise he's read all of these books, but we know that he...
But there's a connection.
Yes,
yeah.
absolutely. And that space is also our replica of his writing space. We have a wonderful photo that was taken in 1969 that you know, shows exactly what his writing space looked like, and his children have loaned us many of the items in his writing room. So we're trying to recreate that space. It's a work in progress, but there is a typewriter that's very much like his typewriter, and visitors are able to type a message in, and we put that on our blog and Facebook and Twitter.
Very cool.
So it's great interaction with our visitors.
Yeah. Very, and then you've also got a gift shop, of course. People can buy Vonnegut books there.
Yes, we have books. You know, one of our more popular items is the coffee mug. It's just a very simple coffee mug, but there is something about it, and it has our logo, which includes Vonnegut's self-portrait drawing. So I think people really like that. We have T-shirts and magnets and hats and all kinds of.
Now, do you actually have any illustrations that Vonnegut did, or because I mean he was quite an artist as well, a visual artist.
We do. We have in our art gallery, mm-hmm. Several pieces that he created. In our gift shop, we actually currently only have one. It's his signature with just his typed name. But we do plan to expand the gift shop to include Vonnegut mm-hmm. art in there.
Yeah, because some of his stuff is just so fantastic
yes.
and great to see.
Yes, and we are happy to bring his artistic collaborator, Joe Pietro, to Indianapolis sometime later in the spring to talk about what it was like to mm-hmm. To work with Kurt Vonnegut on his art. And Joe actually is the keeper of all the Vonnegut art that remains. So we look forward to learning more about how they partnered.
Well, and I know, Julia, that the last time I think that we sat here and chatted on Art of the Matter about the Vonnegut Memorial Library, at that time we knew where the space was going to be, but nothing had been opened yet. It was still sort of an idea that a lot of people were working really hard to make happen. I think maybe the first Night of Vonnegut had taken place, and I know you were already started with some book club stuff. But so now we're here, and the library is open, and you're getting ready for the second annual Night of Vonnegut, which is just a great celebration. One thing I got to ask you on the invite that I saw for it, there's an illustration of a Smith Corona typewriter. Now, is that a Vonnegut illustration, and is that the typewriter?
No. Well, it's not a Vonnegut illustration.
Okay.
It was created by the artist at Big Car.
Mm-hmm.
And
we love
they
Big Car.
Have been great mm-hmm. to work with. It is amazing. We, on occasion, have given them some very short timelines, and they just come up with these wonderful ideas very quickly. Jim Walker and Andy Fry mm-hmm. Have been just wonderful to work with, and we will have new items in our gift shop that will have been created by Big Car. So mm-hmm.
Does this typewriter look like Vonnegut's typewriter?
It does,
yeah.
And we do, as
Very
you know,
cool.
have that typewriter
right.
in the front of our art gallery.
Excellent. Yeah. So now the Night of Vonnegut coming up April 16th. At not the Marat downtown, but the...
Yes, the Marat on Meridian at mm-hmm. Fall Creek.
Exactly, that Marat.
Yes.
It gets a little confusing.
Yes, that is
but.
Confusing, but we're very excited to be at that venue. Mm-hmm. Dinner will be provided by Piper's. Jim Shallow will be our MC again this year.
And Steve Inske, NPR's Morning Edition, local boy, that's fantastic.
And Steve actually called one day and was asking about our hours for the library, and I thought, wait, I know that voice.
Sure.
I know that voice. So we were very excited that Steve was interested in the library, and he actually came in a few times, and we thought, well, I wonder if he'll... be willing to participate in
this
event.
So he's giving the keynote speech for it. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yes, he's a very big Vonnegut fan and is a big supporter of our organization, so we're thrilled to have him.
Nice.
And there will also be dramatic readings of Vonnegut's work. Mm-hmm. And then one program that's very important to us is our outreach with public high schools, and specifically with Vonnegut's alma mater, Shortridge High School. We will be presenting two writing awards, the Kurt Vonnegut Writing Award and the Jane Cox Vonnegut Writing Award, to two students at Shortridge High School. And these are $5,000 scholarships.
Wow.
So we're very excited about presenting those awards. I am one of the few people who are reading those stories right now for this mm-hmm. writing competition. I'm thrilled at what I've seen so far. It's there's just so many interesting ideas out there, and we are very excited about this program and eventually plan to make it a national writing competition.
But so right now, the students who are eligible have to be high school students at Shortridge?
Yes, and actually there are only sophomores are the highest level of high school student at Shortridge.
Right, at Shortridge, because
right
they've started up the new program there.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, so we will be giving these scholarships to sophomores.
Wow.
As they choose.
That's quite a motivator if you're a student at Shortridge.
Yes, and we thought it would look great as they're filling out their college applications to be able to say that they received the Kurt Vonnegut Writing Award or the Jane Cox Vonnegut Writing Award. The Jane Cox Vonnegut Writing Award is provided by Vonnegut's children, Edie Nanny and Mark Vonnegut, and that is to honor the memory of their mother, who helped Vonnegut deal with his World War II memories as he was writing Slaughterhouse-5. She was his editor. She encouraged him. And after 20 years, he was able to create that, that wonderful book.
Well, now that night is really, even though that's certainly a benefit for the Vonnegut Memorial Library, it's really sort of only part of that weekend celebration. Mark Vonnegut's going to be in town, and I know that that you guys are also partnering with NAMI, the National Association of Mental Illness, that they're having an event as well.
Yes, and that is the following day at the Athenaeum at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And that event is focused solely on Mark's book, we're happy to be a sponsor of that.
That's great to connect with them as well.
Yes.
Yeah, and then just as we were about to start this interview, I was opening up my mail, and there was a new release of the Library of America. It has a Kurt Vonnegut collection, Novels and Stories, 63 to 73, that's going to be coming out in May, and just got a copy of that. So that's pretty cool, because there's a connection locally with you as well with that.
Sydney Offit, who is one of our honorary board members, he actually was the editor and wrote the introduction for Look at the Birdie, and he is the editor of this book that you're speaking of. I had the opportunity to meet Sydney in August in New York, and he was a very, very close friend of Vonnegut's, and actually he and Morley Safer and Vonnegut palled around, but he's been a wonderful supporter of the library, and we're thrilled to have his participation.
Yeah, I know, that's great. And this collection includes Cat's Cradle, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, Slaughterhouse-5, and Breakfast of Champions, as well as a bunch of the stories. So that'll be a great collection coming out later this May. I know that you've got one other piece of news you wanted to talk a bit about that involves Ball State.
I do. I just found out today that a professor I've been working with, his name is Ronald Morris, and he teaches a history course at Ball State. He received word that they will be receiving the Ball State University Provost Immersive Learning Grant of $25,000, and these funds are to create media products to enhance visitor experiences at the Vonnegut Library. And initially we had talked about creating an audio tour, but then in our conversations, we imagine more interactive types of experiences for visitors, and the class will actually begin work on this project in January, but we'll be able to do some pre-work, and so we should have a lot of interesting.
That's great news. Congratulations on
Thanks.
That.
Thanks. Yeah, it's great to work with Ball State.
Well, now as far as there's a lot of great things going on with the Vonnegut Memorial Library, so congratulations on all that. For people who just want to come down and check out the library, it's free admission, and what are the hours?
We are open from 12 to 5 every day, except Wednesdays. We're closed on Wednesdays, but we're open on the weekends, even Sunday. We will also, if you call ahead of time, we can do special tours at different times, depending on, what the schedule is. But we've had, like I mentioned, we've had so many visitors, and we're all very excited to give tours of the library.
Travis DiNicola with Julia Whitehead, Executive Director of the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library. The second annual Night of Vonnegut event will take place on April 16th. For more information, visit VonnegutLibrary.org, VonnegutLibrary.org.
Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
April.
April who?
April Fools.
Oh!
that's so cute.
Oh, yeah. Well, that and other funny things, I'm sure. Some that are real, some that are not. You get to pick out which ones. On the counter we call,
What do we do? Aww,
yeah, that's
cute.
Right. Maybe one of these things isn't actually an event going on this weekend.
I'll never tell. And if you can spot the phony event, drop us an email at artofthematter@wfyi.org. What do you win? You get to take us to dinner at...
We'll think of
someplace
something.
Someplace fancy.
Sounds like a great idea.
What do you have?
Saints and Sinners.
I like
Gregory it. Gregory Hancock Dance Theater is presenting Saints and Sinners next weekend, April 8th and 9th, out at the Pike Performing Arts Center, featuring Joan of Arc and the Seven Deadly Sins. You know, they know how to put on a good party.
wait. Are they inviting us to dress as one of our favorite saints or sinners or sins?
You know, you could. Why don't you do that, Sharon? You should show up there dressed as your
I'll
favorite
I'll report
sin.
Back.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. The kids left. The dog died. Now what? This is not a joke. It is a show that opens, if you're listening to us Friday night, you've missed it because it's on stage right now. But on Saturday afternoon, you could probably still score a ticket for tonight. It is a new play by Carol Kaplan Lahner. It is a musical comedy that salutes those valiantly struggling with divorce on their hands, gravity on their bodies, grandchildren on their self-images, and the AARP dating scene on their egos. Aging gracefully is the final frontier. Where is this? On stage at Theater on the Square. The kids left, the dog died, now what?
Wow.
On stage at Tots.
You know what I want to see this weekend?
What do you want to see?
This.
And what is this?
This is this.
Okay,
it's not actually even an April Fool's joke. This is a new play that's just opened at the Phoenix Theater. It runs from now through April 24th, and it's sort of about a group of late 30s, early 40s friends that sort of get together, and in the course of playing some games, a lot of interesting stories come out. And this is the name of the play.
Cool.
This.
I like this.
T-H-I-S.
T-H-I-S. I like it. This is something interesting. It's on Wednesday, April 13th, 4 to 5:15. It's a presentation at the Indiana Medical History Museum. It's called Sherlock Holmes and the Beginning of Modern Forensic Science. What it is a presentation on how the Sherlock Holmes stories, and I know you're a fan, mm-hmm. so you might like this, how the Sherlock Holmes stories reflect applications of scientific principles to criminal investigations in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. There's an exhibit on view at the Medical History Museum that goes with this opening that day, April 13th, running through May 14th. So if you have some budding scientists in your life or you find yourself transfixed before CSI, that's your exhibit.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, two fun schedules for summer concerts got released this week. One is for the ISO Symphony on the Prairie, and the other is for the concerts at the 1-800-QUIT-NOW concert series at the lawn at White River State Park. And up at Connor Prairie, at Symphony on the Prairie this summer, among other great musicians, Arlo Guthrie is going to be up there, as well as Flash Cadillac, Time for Three, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy,
wow.
a whole bunch of other fun groups. And then down at White River State Park this summer, amongst the groups playing, Florence and the Machine, as well as Arcade Fire and Alison Krauss.
Wow.
Yeah,
I need my
lineups.
Dancing shoes.
Yeah, so we'll have a lot more about those summer concerts, coming up throughout the summer, but just want to give people a little preview.
Absolutely. Hey, you have just about 1 month left to go see the first of three consecutive exhibits about the arts and crafts movement at the T.C. Steele State Historic Site. Easy for me to say, right? In this home, through April 30th, there is the first, as I say, first installation of three of some unusual arts and crafts era pottery, metalwork, graphic arts, furniture, and architectural elements. You can find out more about that by Googling it or by going to the Indiana State Museum's website because they own and operate the Steele site.
Very good.
Yeah.
Hey, one last thing I've got, Sharon, and this is actually not a joke for April Fools. Unfortunately, I don't know if you're familiar with the local musician, Kate Lamont.
Yes.
And she was in a hit-and-run accident when she was down in Austin, Texas for South by Southwest. She was performing down there and working down there. And she's still down there, and she was hit pretty seriously, and it really hurt her in the mouth, especially, which is awful for a singer.
A singer, yeah.
And so there's, and she's a self. self-employed musician and a single mom, and her work in that is really her only income. And so there's going to be a fundraiser and auction coming up on Saturday, April 16th at the Harrison Performing Arts Center, at the Harrison Center. And we'll have more information soon about that, but mark your calendars now for that evening for that fundraiser for Kate Lamont, and we wish her well.
Very good. Absolutely. Part of supporting local artists. Listen, there's so much more going on, but we are out of time, so we'll be back again next week, no fooling, with more of
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
What's one of the most daunting assignments for a choral conductor? Oh, how about the Bach B minor Mass? Well, Dr. Eric Stark is about to conduct it for the first time with the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir and the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. And Sharon Gamble invited him in to talk about why it's a glorious challenge, and also about a music tour he just returned from.
Well, as we're having our conversation, you've just returned from a trip abroad, which means you were in the air on Bach's birthday yesterday. Yeah.
And we gave him a shout-out from about 38,000 feet.
I love that. Not that it was related to the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir, but tell us about the trip.
Well, this was with my some of my students from Butler University, where I teach. We took members of our choir and our orchestra and our wind ensemble to Greece and Italy. It was spring break. And so we did a performance tour, stayed about 2 hours outside of Athens in a beautiful little coastal village of Naplion, about 17,000 people, and in the middle of miles and miles of orange groves with the blossoms and the smell just being wonderful. Mm. And we sang at the first parliament house of Greece from the 19th century, when Greece became a unified country. In Naplion, a very small, very live acoustic with all of our singers and trombones and percussion instruments going. It
made is that what I'm still hearing?
Yes, okay. It is, in fact. Sorry about that.
No worries.
Sang a joint concert at a festival at the University of Bologna with about 100 singers from the university joining my students, which was a lot of fun. And then in Rome, sang for Mass at the Vatican this weekend, as well as a couple of performances, our final one at the Church of Sant'Ignazio in downtown Rome.
What was singing at the Vatican like?
It was great. Very moving for all of us, you know, regardless of one's kind of background or inclination, to be in that space and in that beautiful and inspiring edifice and to just see the art kind of hovering over you. And it was a beautiful sunny day, and the sun was streaming through the glass windows up at the top of the dome, and huge beams of sunlight hitting the bronze canopy and just lighting kind of the different colored marbles and glass. And so it was really terrific. We sang five pieces, and as we were discussing a moment ago, you know, it's kind of seat of the pants deal. They point to you when it's time for the next one, and away you go. So it's a good thing the students were ready.
And is that just because there are so many?
There's so many services going on all the time.
So many choirs from around the world who come and sing.
Exactly. Yeah. And they've got it down to a science. It's a very well-oiled machine. But just for the visiting choir, which we were, you know, you just really have to have your wits fully about you. And
your student organist in particular, tell about.
She did a great job. You know, I can't imagine what it must feel like to sit down at the console of the Vatican organ, you know, big four manual job. But they said to her and to me, you'll probably just use this preset and these two manuals, and if you want it to be a little louder, drop down to this one. And so I was conducting a setting of an Ave Maria that we have with organ accompaniment, and we got to the middle section, which should be a little louder, and she was kind of to my left as I was conducting, so I leaned over and pointed down as if, you know, move your hands down to the other manual. And she got the clue right away, and the music director from the Vatican was standing right there, and he came on, pulled on a couple more stops for her.
Wow.
And it was just as if we had rehearsed it that
way. I can't imagine not having a moment's rehearsal time and just, boom, go. I'm always impressed by musicians in the sense that there are so many different ways to be a musician and so many different skill sets. Some people can play by ear. Some people can sight read. But the best musicians have to incorporate all of those skill sets and also to have nerves of steel.
There's a lot of plates spinning on sticks all at the same time when we're musicians, right? And that's one of the things that I love about it is kind of the spontaneous moment where something happens that we didn't expect. Mm-hmm. And now what do we do? How do we panic and kind of withdraw, or do we embrace whatever the possibility might be and do something that could be, you know, special and better than we ever thought of it being?
Mm. When you go on a tour like this, is it for the purpose of the student musicians getting experience? Are you recruiting for Butler, a little of both?
I think it's primarily for the students we already have. It also depends on where the destination may be. We don't, as you may imagine, recruit lots and lots of students from Greece and Italy, although we'd be happy to have them. But I'm a firm believer in the manifold lessons music can teach us in multiple performances. Let's not just do this one thing one or two times, but let's do it again and again and again and get as deep into the piece as we possibly can. And so living together, traveling together, performing together in different spaces and for different kinds of audiences, I think helps us kind of plumb the depths of being musicians and in a way that we can't when we're here doing kind of the same show or the same for the same audience in a similar hall. Those tours really have a way of forging those skills and bringing new skills to the surface that maybe we hadn't been aware of before.
Develops a deep sense of trust as well.
Yeah.
I'm going to sit at this organ I've never seen before, and you are going to sing with me,
and it's
all going to
be
fine.
Just fine.
Speaking of risk-taking.
nice turn.
and I should say you're doing a fabulous job considering you got back from your trip what time last night?
Oh, got back to Indianapolis about midnight last
night.
Okay,
you're doing great. You're doing great. The Bach B minor Mass, one of the jewels in the crown of a conductor, yes?
Absolutely, and singers, and of course anybody who loves classical music or music designed as an expression of worship or faith. It's all those things and more. And as I was kind of sorting the laundry for my trip this morning and thinking about our conversation today, was thinking that although there's so much to be said about this music, it also is music that is greatly served by, I think, just experiencing it and not trying to put labels on these things. Because of the miracle of the B minor Mass and of Bach's music is that there's just layer after layer after layer of meaning. And so much of that, I think, is based on the experience of the person hearing it and the background that they bring, the knowledge of music, the experience of spirituality, the appreciation for musical architecture, if you will. All mm-hmm. those kinds of things mean that each person has a different kind of experience listening to a piece like this. And so the conversation can only take us so far.
It can be a little intimidating, too, if you it's possible to over-prepare for hearing it live the first time.
Mm-hmm.
If you start delving into all of the essays about the numerology
yeah.
and the symbolism.
More than any other piece of music that a person like me would consider conducting, this is the one that is the scariest because, you know, typically a conductor really has to feel as if he or she has done all the homework before that first rehearsal. And I know what Helmut Rilling says about this piece, and I know what Donald Tobey says about it, and what Christoph Wolff says about it, and I know the performances that Thomas Beecham used to give of this piece when he used thousands of people, and I know the performances of somebody else who uses a dozen. And my gosh, if for this piece there's so much out there, if we were to wait until I had done all of the homework or another conductor had studied everything there is,
you'd
never
be retired.
So at some point you just have to say, all right, it's time to do this.
That is a good question. How how do you know you have enough of a philosophy, for want of a better word, mm-hmm. of the piece that you're ready to conduct? And this is not your first Bach B minor.
This is my first time to conduct it.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, I've waited.
No chance as a student to?
Well, I sang it. This was actually the first piece I ever sang as a graduate student in the choral conducting program at Indiana University.
Wow.
And as an aspiring conductor, of course, I was thinking someday I hope I'll get to conduct this piece. But more than any other thing I studied at the time, I just had an awareness that I should really wait a while on this. And so that was 1988, and so here we are 23 years later, finally picking up the stick and going for it. So it will be my first time through the piece, and I'm never completely comfortable. Never feel like I know every answer that may come up in a rehearsal situation or in every issue that might arise in a performance. But at some point, as we already said, you just have to kind of do it, because the music doesn't live on the shelf. It needs to be out in the air and in our ears and in our brains and hearts and spirits. So here we go, and there's a chance I'll do something goofy. I suppose that might make it more interesting to come and see the performance.
This is why live performance is always more interesting than recordings.
Yeah. Well, there's always that you know, what if, and it's like, working with a guest artist like a soloist, for example. You know, professional musicians who've sung these pieces or studied these pieces for years, as have I. And we have usually 2 or 3 days to kind of live together as musicians before a performance, and then we practice and kind of decide, okay, you're going to do this here, I'm going to do this, and this is where we'll meet in the middle. And invariably something happens in the performance that we didn't plan on or we didn't even discuss. And it's in that moment that things can either be really great and inspired, or you might have a little bit of a gear clash or something like that. But I am kind of a risk taker in certain ways. I love the spontaneous kind of what's going to happen next.
No net.
Yeah, yeah.
Performing without a net. You have a partner in crime, so to speak, or a partner in risk in that you have a scholar in residence. What does a scholar in residence do? And tell us about him.
He answers the phone when I call up and say, "My God, what have I gotten myself into?"
It reassures you.
Vance George is our scholar in residence for this performance. Good friend of mine and of the symphonic choirs. He guest conducted our performance of the Von Williams Stone and Nobis Pacem in 2005. He's a Hoosier. From Napanee, Indiana, a graduate of Goshen College and Indiana University, and the conductor emeritus of the San Francisco Symphony Chorus, Grammy Award-winning conductor emeritus, has prepared and conducted this piece multiple times. And actually, he was doing some traveling last summer when I was in Washington, where I spend some time when I'm not teaching here. And so he stayed with us, and we spent a couple of mornings over coffee with the scores out and kind of looking at pieces. So that was his first job, was to help me kind of flesh out my initial conceptions of the piece. He will be with us for the performance and actually for the last couple of rehearsals. He's going to speak to my class of graduate conducting students at Butler University about the piece and about his experience with them. And he's going to deliver some words on music prior to both performances. And he's as I say, he's conducted the piece. He's prepared it for Robert Shaw. He's prepared it for many conductors and has lived with and studied it for many, many years. So he'll bring a perspective that's very rich and broad and wonderful.
And he'll provide another set of ears out in the hall while you're
absolutely
rehearsing,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
I know you're going to answer this very diplomatically, but is it at all intimidating to have somebody with that much experience with a piece?
Yeah. You know, why not just give the baton to the guy who really knows what he's doing?
No, I didn't mean it in that way. But, I mean, he's not going to say, I know one of the dichotomies about the piece is sometimes it's performed with very few voices,
right,
to a part, and sometimes it's performed with not hundreds, but many
larger
voices.
Larger ensemble.
Is he going to advocate for one end of that?
Well, he
spectrum?
Was a conductor of a symphonic chorus,
right,
of even larger size than ours, and so he knows that we're performing this with a major U.S. symphony orchestra that performs on contemporary instruments, or modern instruments,
right,
we might say, in a large-ish hall. And so those things kind of mandate, I think, an approach that admits a group of 90 to 100 singers, as we're using. Although an approach that I hope he will feel is historically informed kind of aesthetically agile and astute as to what all the musicians on the stage are doing. I think that's an approach that can be taken with modern or period instruments and ensembles large or small, and one that serves the music really well.
Do you feel that, what do you feel is the right time after this performance to come back to the Bach B minor?
Do you like to conduct it again?
Uh-huh. Do you want to let a little time elapse?
Boy,
Or ask again later.
Well, yeah. I often feel like after I kind of do a piece the first time, that I would, at the drop of a hat, do it again, like tomorrow morning. And I'm sure I'll feel the same way after this. We should probably ask Michael Petrie, our executive director of the Symphonic Choir, when we could market it again a second time. Although it is a piece that I think needs to be heard more often than it is. It's because of its challenges. I can't think of the Berlin Zing Academy. Did one of the first full performances of the piece in the 19th century and took about 2.5 years to rehearse it.
Wow.
So we don't hear the piece done frequently, and yet it has so much to offer us. And it connects us, I think, it gives us an experience that helps us connect with other pieces we might also do. So I hope it's not, the last time the choir did it was before I was the conductor. It was probably 11 years ago, I think. And I hope that we don't wait that long again. Long answer to your quick question.
Sharon Gamble with Dr. Eric Stark. You can hear him conduct Bach's Great Mass in B minor with the ISO on Friday, April 15th and Saturday, April 16th at the Hilbert Circle Theater. Find out more at indiechoir.org, again, indiechoir.org, and be sure to check out Eric's blog. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 when I find out about the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's concert with cellist Joshua Roman.
I'll chat with mystery writer Brian Freeman about his new book and his upcoming visit to Indianapolis.
And I'll get a preview of the Indiana Artisan Marketplace. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call What Do We Do?
So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.